will host a signing ceremony for Russia and the United States for a new nuclear weapons agreement. It is an accord intended to cut the number of long-range nuclear weapons held by both countries. A new agreement could follow the 1991 Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or the START Agreement, that required the United States and the then Soviet Union to reduce arsenals by one quarter to about 6,000 nuclear warheads each. Police in Norway say at least three people are dead in a train accident. A group of cars rolled away from a cargo train and crashed into a building in an industrial port. The victims were working inside, and the building collapsed. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly. The Danville Barbershop Chorus will present their annual spring concert Sunday afternoon with favorite songs like Hey, Look Me Over, On the Sunny Side of the Street, and As Time Goes By. On the Wednesday edition of Live and Local, the Danville Quartet, Four on the Floor, will join us for a couple of songs and to chat up the show. Live and Local is your connection to local music and more, weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting What It Is, featuring Mavis Staples, Booker T, and J.J. Gray on March 30th. More information on this and other events can be found online at KrannertCenter.com.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. This hour's interview comes from the Focus 580 archives, so that means that we'll not be taking calls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with economist Joseph Stiglitz. He served as a member of the Council of Economic Advisers during the Clinton administration. After that, he became the chief economist and senior vice president of the World Bank. He is now on the faculty at Columbia University in New York. He has also taught at a number of other places, including Yale, Princeton, Stanford, and MIT. He, in 2001, was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics. And he has written a lot about economics and has a new book out that we'll be talking about this morning that takes a look at where we are now in our economic crisis looks at some of the root causes of the Great Recession of 2008. He says that while many people might argue that this downturn was impossible for anyone to predict, he argues that, in fact, it was the product of years of neglect. He also says that after escaping a near-death experience, America now has a unique opportunity to fix the problems of our financial system and to move toward a more fair society. The book is just out recently. It's published by W.W. Norton, so I'm sure that you can find it if you want to read it. Today, he's in Chicago. He'll be giving a talk on the campus of the University of Chicago tonight at the International House. That's at 6. So if people are listening to us up in that area, I'm sure that you would be welcome. You could stop by. Otherwise, of course, if you're interested in reading Freefall, you can look for the book. And here, we welcome people into the conversation. You can ask questions, make comments. We do hope that people will be brief, so we can accommodate as many as possible, but your questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we also do have email. You may email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Professor Stiglitz, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Nice to be here.
We appreciate it. The questions that people ask, we've talked about this. A lot of people have talked about this, and people continue to ask the same questions. The lead question, the very first one, always is, well, how exactly did this happen? You address this in the book, and in fact, you have a section where you raise that very question, and you managed to answer it in brief, at least, I think, in about 2.5 pages. So maybe we can start there. This is the section that says here, the story in short. Well, let's start there. What is the story in short?
Well, the story in short is the banks engaged in reckless lending. They helped create a bubble. And when the bubble broke, the financial system was in total collapse. And there were a number of things that made things worse. The huge bets the the banks made against each other, these so-called credit default swaps, obviously increased the risk, the fact that each bank didn't know its own balance sheet, let alone that of any other bank, so the credit markets froze. One of the things I emphasize in the book is that when you think about what I just described, you have to ask, well, why did these things happen? That's not the way the capitalist system is supposed to work. And so I go through a process I call like peeling back the onion. Every time you get an answer, you have to ask, why was that? So you ask, why did the financial markets behave so badly? And the answer I give to that is that they had incentives for short-sighted behavior and excessive risk-taking. And then you have to ask, well, why was that? And that deals with problems of corporate governance, separation of ownership and control, what I call the problem of agency. But the other part of it is that we've had these kind of problems over and over again. The banks have been bailed out repeatedly. There was only one period in the history of the world of capitalism when that these things haven't happened, and that was the short period of, you know, three, four decades after the Great Depression when we adopted regulatory systems that prevented the banks from engaging in this kind of excess risk-taking. But then beginning around 1980 with Reagan in the United States, Thatcher in the UK, we stripped away the regulations. We didn't adopt new regulations for the changing financial structure. And so this these policies of deregulation really allow this to happen. Then you have to ask the question: well, why did that happen? And then the answer to that, in part, is two parts. One of them is that the special interests, the banks, wanted it to happen, and they paid, they exercised their influence on the political process to strip away these regulations. Five lobbyists for every congressman. But the second one, I put some blame on my own profession. The economists put forward ideas, you might say crazy ideas, not well-supported ideas, but ideas that markets were self-regulating. And that provided the intellectual framework which encouraged this view that bubbles couldn't exist and that markets were self-correcting, could just take care of themselves.
Yeah, it seems that people in looking for someone to blame want to try to pick one of three groups. Either they say the problem was irresponsible consumers or greedy bankers or regulators who were asleep at the switch. Is it, in fact, all three?
In some sense, it's all three, but in different degrees of culpability. The bankers are the people who did the bad lending. They are the people who were supposed to know, who were supposed to manage risk. They're the people who know what individuals can repay, what they can't. First-time homeowners really don't understand markets. They don't understand the vagaries of interest rates. They don't understand the complicated financial products that were being created. So the first culpability lies with the banks, and I think we should make that should be perfectly clear. The regulators weren't just asleep at the switch. The financial sector paid good money to make sure that they got regulators that didn't believe in regulation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you paid good money to get those kinds of regulators, you can't blame the regulators. Those were the regulators that in a sense they bought by their major campaign contributions and their lobbying activities. So, you know, sort of like the kid who steals candy from the store, and do you blame the cop who was not there, or do you blame the kid? Of course you blame the kid. But if the thief actually paid the cop to go away, or paid the boss of the cop, you don't blame the cop. You have to say something was wrong with the system that allowed the cop to be reassigned. And there is a problem with our political system.
Just one other thing, and then I have a caller I get to. I have the feeling that I know that going back several years, there were people who were saying that real estate in this country was wildly overvalued, and that everybody, at some level, everybody seemed to know it. And people said, really, this can't continue. It's not sustainable. It can't continue to grow. And people were saying that, I think, for several years before the bubble burst, which makes you wonder, was there anybody who was in a position to say, wait a minute, let's pull the reins in here and see if we can avert disaster before it comes?
There were a lot of people were saying that something needed to be done. As you said, not only was there a sense in the market of anybody involved in real estate, but the experts, Bob Shuler at Yale, was pointing this out. I was arguing this. Lots of people were. The problem was that there were too many people making too much money that they didn't want anything to be done. Alan Greenspan said, "Oh, don't worry about it. There's just a little froth in the economy." The Congress had actually given the Federal Reserve authority to do something about these problems, but the Federal Reserve decided not to do anything about it because of this ideology. Who are we to tell the market what the right price is? And we know that bubbles don't exist because of our belief that markets always work. So it was this combination of interest and ideology that overwhelmed common sense.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is economist Joseph Stiglitz. He is the author of the new book, Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy. It's published by W.W. Norton. It's just recently out. He is a winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics, has authored several books, including Globalization and Its Discontents, Making Globalization Work, and the $3 Trillion War. He teaches at Columbia University and is today in Chicago, where he's going to speak on the University of Chicago campus. Questions are welcome. We have a couple people here ready to go. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455 and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll start out with a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. I wonder if you've left out at least two parties that I could think of. One is the congressional forces that were pushing to have housing and home ownership to be available to large groups of population that they believed were underserved, and therefore they encouraged the lending to parties who had no money down or had poor credit history, and this then linked up with their efforts and pressure on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, both with political appointments and with policy decisions. This is both on the part of the administration that you were part of, unfortunately, the Clinton administration, and congressional figures like Barney Frank, etc. So there's that whole lending to parties that really had no business having owning based on their poor credit rating or lack of credit rating. And then the other part was the encouragement that of the, the sky's the limit real estate growth, which, again, was encouraged by political administrations. So I wonder if you could talk about that and talk about the placing of political figures into regulatory positions with a and oversight of, the reins in the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac area.
The caller raised several very good questions.
I deal with most of those questions in my book. Let me first deal with the Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae issue. If that had been the only problem, this crisis would have been costly but a fraction of the cost, and we would not have had a major recession. You know, the fact that we've needed a $700 billion bailout bill for the banks, not for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, for the banks, shows it was the banks, the private banks, that were at the core of the problem, the freezing of their lending, of the credit flows because of their excessive risk-taking and their bad lending. You know, I wish it were the case that a lecture from an administration that says that we think home ownership is a good thing. There was bipartisan support. Bush said it. Clinton said it. I wish that lectures like that would get the banks to do the right thing, because if that were the case, then the lectures now, the banks ought to give more credit to small businesses, would have some effect. The banks shouldn't give so much money out in bonuses. It's really causing all kinds of political discord. That would have some effect. But unfortunately, lectures don't really shape bank policy. Evidence of the role of the other aspects of bank behavior that were so important in leading to this crisis, it provided by AIG. Here we have one firm, where the bailout cost the taxpayer $180 billion. You know, that's an amount that is really hard to fathom. And that was had nothing to do with the lending to poor people that was encouraged by administrations in their attempt to expand home ownership. Then the other point that I would raise is the following. Those of us who believed that that extending home ownership was a good thing always believed that there is a home that's appropriate for every person. You know, if your income is $50,000, you can't live in a mansion. If it's $30,000, you have to scale down the size of home that you can afford. The problem was that the banks didn't make the right risk analysis. They weren't interested in making judgments about what was the right house for each individual. They bought into the bubble mentality. They made loans that they knew the individuals couldn't afford, but they said, oh, don't worry about that, because there's a free lunch for everybody. The price is going to go up. We're going to make a lot of money out of the fees, but you don't have to worry about the fact that you're getting more and more in debt with all these fees because, and this is the ultimate dishonesty, they said the bubble will go on forever and ever. When it comes time to refinance, the price will be so high that you'll be able not only to refinance it without difficulty, but you will be able to take out additional money to support your lifestyle beyond your income. So, when we look at what the financial sector did to encourage especially people who were ill-informed, who were first-time home buyers, to buy houses beyond their ability to afford, you have to put primary culpability on those mortgage brokers and the securitization process that wanted these pieces of paper so that they could sell them all over the world. The interesting thing is that the lending that was focused on underserved communities, the Community Reinvestment Act, there's some evidence that I cite in my book that shows that those loans where there was explicit attention to the risk actually performed better than other kinds of subprime lending. On the broader issue of political appointees. You know, first, the model of the what I'll call the government-sponsored enterprise, the GSEs, was from the start a very flawed model. In 1968, these Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were privatized. And that meant that they had these incentives to behave like any other private bank, And they had incentives to engage in excess risk-taking, even though that was not their mandate. The confusion was generated by the question of were their decks underwritten by the government? And it was supposedly pretty clear that they weren't, except for one fact. They were too big to fail. And they were bailed out, just like the other too-big-to-fail banks were bailed out. And the market was smart enough to recognize that. And that fact, that they were too big to fail, gave them access to money at cheaper rates, which gave them a competitive advantage. And that's precisely the problem that we have today. Too-big-to-fail banks, access to cheaper money, and an unlevel playing field that distorts the financial sector and distorts the economy.
We have several callers. I want to thank the last and go on to another person here in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Yes, it's a great honor to speak to you, sir. As soon as I heard that the book had come out, I went and bought it off the internet. So I've only read a little bit of it, I have to say, because I'm too busy. But I just wanted to ask you a few things. Obviously, these are big questions, but given that we're still in the crisis, technically, even though the government tells us we're coming out of it, Obama has turned to Geithner and Summers, you know, as we all know, in the wake of the crisis. And why do you think, number one, he turned to them in particular? Why have they let themselves become obsessed with deficits of recent, given that unemployment is still at 9.7%? What do you see as happening if Obama and the Congress continue on this particular course? Because here in Illinois, we're in a terrible state fiscal crisis, which is almost worse than the national crisis. And on this particular station, our weathermen were just fired in connection with that. So we're all interested in hearing about how we can get out of this and how we can convince Obama and those around him to make the right moves in that regard.
Those are all good questions. Let me first begin with the question of why he may have stuck with people who were so closely associated with the failures of the past, including the deregulation that caused the crisis in the first place, or at least allowed it to happen.
Right.
I think there was a gamble. He wanted to maintain stability. He wanted to maintain confidence in the financial markets. He was, I think, overly influenced by the financial markets, who wanted to believe that the bubble prices were reality. All that we needed is a restoration of confidence. And so the first priority was to maintain stability and confidence. My own view was, of course, that the bubble was a bubble, that we were living in a dream, and that the problems were much deeper, and therefore we were not going to get out of the crisis so easily. And unfortunately, it turned out to be the case that those like me who held to the more pessimistic view were correct. And the result of this is that what we did, the stimulus bill was too small, did not succeed in getting unemployment to an acceptable level,
right?
And we are where we are today. Now, let me say, the economy is far from being out of the woods. You know, there's a sense that the free fall is come to an end. We may have hit the bottom. Growth has returned, and people feel good about that. But as you say, and as people all over the country feel, we're not really in recovery until jobs are returned.
Right.
And it is still the case that more than one out of five Americans who would like a full-time job cannot get one.
Wow.
And the official statistics now, CBO and other sources, say that it's unlikely that we will be back to normal unemployment rates until the middle of the decade. And that's where your second question becomes very relevant. I don't understand why there is a return to this kind of fiscal fetishism. You know, the banks short-sighted behavior got us into the mess. And now, you know, ironically, having seen how bad the banks' economic judgments are, we're again beginning to listen to them, and they're saying over and over again, the deficit, 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 and trying to persuade us to cut back spending. But if we do that, we're going to have a double dip. We're going to have another recession. But it's also very short-sighted. It's easy to show that if you take spending now, if you spend money now on investments in education, infrastructure, technology, the long-run national debt will actually be lower than if we cut back. All that it needs is about a 5 to 6% return on those investments. And the reason is fairly simple, because if we spend money now, the economy is going to be stronger, and that means more tax revenue. But if we spend money on investments, that means we're going to getting returns for years, decades to come. And again, that means more tax revenue. So even if you only look at the deficit, you forget about the suffering of workers, of homeowners, you just focus on narrowly on the deficit, if that's what you're concerned about, it is really foolish to cut back now before the economy is really on a solid road to recovery. And as you finally said, the problems at the state level really exemplify the weaknesses of the economy. All over the country, the states are suffering for obvious reason. Many of the states depend very heavily on property taxes. Property values are way down. Average values of residential real estate are down 30% from their peak. And in some areas, it's down much, much more. The result of this is there's a shortfall of revenue of $200 billion or more. And the states have a balanced budget framework, which means that when their revenues go down, they either have to cut back on expenditures or raise taxes. That's equivalent to a negative stimulus that undoes almost half of the stimulus that's being provided at the federal level. What is so disturbing to me is that a recession is exactly the time when these services of the states are so needed. Another aspect, very disturbing aspect to me, is that young people who are out of a job typically want to go improve their skills by going to school. But unfortunately, the stakes are in such bad shape that they're cutting back. In California, teachers are being furloughed 2 days a month, and that's in anticipation of layoffs in the coming year. So while we should be investing in our young people who can't get jobs and increasing their productivity in the future, unfortunately, it's not what we're doing.
We're at the midpoint here, and I have several callers, and I want to get on to some others. I want to come back just quickly to one thing. You've said that you feel one of the big problems here was the fact that these big banks knew that they could take risks, make risky decisions, and knew that they couldn't lose, because either if they won, they got to keep the money. If they lost, they knew that the government would bail them out. At the same time, when there was all this discussion of the bailouts, many people said it was something that we simply had to hold our noses and do, because if we didn't, if we allowed these big banks to fail, then we could have a worldwide financial collapse virtually unlike anything we'd ever seen, and that if we didn't do the bailout, we would be in even worse shape than we are now. Was it a mistake? Should we have let these big banks simply fail?
We almost surely needed to come to the rescue. That's what you mean by banks that are too big to fail. But what we did, the way we did it, was really unconscionable. There were several things that went wrong. You know, when we give welfare payments to poor people, reform of our Welfare Act in 1996, what we said is we're going to pose conditions. If we give you money, you have to go out, either look for a job or go into a training program. when we gave money to the banks, we didn't put any conditions. And what did that mean? Well, the same short-sighted, reckless behavior that had brought us to the brink of collapse, we didn't change that. We didn't change the incentives. So what did they do? Money that was intended to be used for increased lending, to recapitalize the banks, to make them sounder, that money poured out of the banks into dividends, into bonuses. And so what we saw was that the bankers did very well, but the objective was not achieved. The second thing that we did that was so terrible is that when we gave them money, we should have gotten back value in return. When Warren Buffett gave money to Goldman Sachs, he got value in return. But when we gave money to the banks, we got back. We were cheated, to put it very, very, very bluntly. We got cheated. You know, we don't know whether it was ineptness or whether they were working for the other side, but we got cheated. The Congressional Oversight Panel did a study of the value of the preferred shares and warrants, the other financial instruments that we got in return for the money that we gave them. And we gave them, we got 67 cents on the dollar. Some of the deals, we got less than 50 cents on the dollar. If we had gotten fair value, our national debt would be lower, and we wouldn't be under such pressure to pull back our spending. Pulling back spending will mean unemployment will be higher and growth will be lower.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is economist Joseph Stiglitz. He was a member of the Council of Economic Advisers during the Clinton administration. After that, he became chief economist, senior vice president of the World Bank. That was between 1997 and 2000. Currently, he is university professor at Columbia University in New York. His new book is titled Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy. It's published by W.W. Norton. He's in Chicago today, where he's going to give a talk at the International House at the University of Chicago campus. That's tonight at 6 o'clock. Questions are welcome, and we have several. The lines are all full, so again, we'll try to get in as many as we can. Going next to a caller in Belgium, line 4. Hello.
Hello. And you've just started talking about the question I'm going to deal with, and that's, during the last several years, we've always made sure that we voted in the person that said no new taxes. And we've had no new taxes for a long time. We don't pay very high taxes. But yet all these problems go back, especially the governmental problems, go back to the fact that they don't have enough money to function. And the rate they were set was set back in 1977 or something like that. That's 33 years ago. Seems to me these politicians we're electing are lying to us in saying no new taxes, when taxes are going to help us solve some of these problems. And isn't it time to do that?
Well, I think it's clear that there is very high returns for spending on certain basic public investments. And the underspending in public investments has a very big cost. We saw that in the New Orleans floods, the breaking of the bridges in Minnesota. But there are more fundamental costs. You know, the big innovation of the end of the 20th century was the Internet, and that was financed by the government. But if we don't do the kind of basic research, we won't have the next set of investments that are going, the next set of ideas that are going to fuel the economy for the next burst of innovation. So, you're absolutely right. What worries me so much is that this crisis, brought on by the financial sector, who were among those who argued for low taxes, has now depleted the treasuries all over the world of money so that they have now less resources for meeting the myriad of needs that are faced by countries all over the world. There's one more point I'd like to make, and that is the following. There are some taxes that actually can improve the efficiency of the economy. If we direct more of our tax structure to taxing things that are bad, that impose costs on others, then we discourage things that are bad at the same time that we raise revenue. What are some of those things? Well, obvious example is pollution. If we tax pollution, we can generate revenue and discourage pollution, get cleaner air, cleaner water. And so that's a way of raising revenue at the same time making our society better. Well, another source of problems for our society, for our economy, are the financial sector. They polluted the whole world with toxic assets. Mismanagement of our financial system has imposed enormous cost on all Americans and all people all over the world. Homeowners, workers, taxpayers have all suffered. So a tax, especially on the too big to fail banks that risk imposing costs once again on the rest of us, is a way of raising revenues and actually correcting some of the distortions in our current economy. And I was very happy to see that Obama seems to be moving in that direction.
All right, again, I want to thank the caller. Go on to another, Champaign County, line 3. Hello. Is there a caller there, Champaign County, line 3? All right, let's go to Champaign, line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I have a couple points, but actually going back to one that David talked about, and you led in regard to you know, we should have a solid interest in these banks. But then some of the politicians are running around talking about socialism, you know, and all this kind of stuff. So anyway, and that's certainly. Mine was in terms of derivatives. What fact did that play? There was an interesting program last night about the warning and what is the name? Bourne? Tried to raise, you know.
Brooklyn Bourne.
Yeah. What's your take on that?
The Brooksley Bourne was very outspoken, very clear that the derivatives represented a real risk to our economy. Warren Buffett has referred to them as financial weapons of mass destruction. When I was on the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, we began to call attention to the riskiness of these. Unfortunately, those in the financial market were making a lot of money off of these credit default swaps and other derivatives. And then she thought that her case was made very forcefully by the failure of long-term capital management, this very large hedge fund, which had to be bailed out. The worry was that the failure of one hedge fund could bring down the total global financial system. And she thought that that made the case really compelling for doing something about derivatives. But Summers, Rubin, and Greenspan all put enormous amount of political pressure to make sure that nothing happened. And unfortunately, now we're 10 years later, 12 years later, nothing effective has yet been done. The derivatives were at the center of the problems in the collapse of the AIG, which, as I mentioned before, cost taxpayers $180 billion. And it's an amount that's hard to fathom. We used to argue endless hours spent arguing how do we spend, you know, much smaller amounts, a billion here, a billion there, and then almost in a moment, checks for $180 billion were written, and the taxpayer will almost surely get back at most a fraction of that amount, particularly if you think about interest and compensation for risk borne. Unfortunately, the big banks that make a lot of money out of these are continuing to resist doing anything. Interesting thing is that it's now been discovered that they are being used not just for, you might say, managing and creating risk. They're also a pivotal part of the way in which tax evasion, and other forms of deception that the financial markets really excelled in. Recent article pointing out the role that these played in Greece's financial problems, because Goldman Sachs used these in a deliberate attempt to make sure that people did not were not able to see the state of Greece's financial status.
We again, I've got to move along here because we have some other callers. I do want to get in a question here that's come in by email from someone who has a rather practical question about where we're heading. They want to, you to talk about inflation, and the listener wants to know, do you expect inflation to run rampant sometime in the, over the next few years in a response to our having printed so much money trying to save the economy? The listener says they ask because it's making their decision on whether or not they want to retire a lot more difficult. Do you have a thought about that?
Yes, I do. First, if they're worried about their retirement, the thing that they should buy is inflation index bonds. They're called TIPS. So you can get now government bonds that yield about 2% now, a little more than 2%, not bad, and where the return is guaranteed in real terms, so the returns go up with inflation. So anybody worried about that, that's what they should be doing. Now, in terms of how worried am I about inflation, it is very natural seeing the blowing up of the deficits, the national debt, and the balance, the expansion of the balance sheet of the Fed, the printing of money, to worry about it. Right now, given the excess capacity, the real problem is deflation, not inflation. The Fed says, don't worry, we will take out this excess liquidity from the market as soon as inflationary pressures start to build up. Anybody looking at how the Fed has managed the economy in the last 10 years will not feel very confident that they will manage this whole process deftly. The issue, though, is whether they will step on the brakes too hard or whether they will allow inflation actually to take place. And there's something about central bankers that makes them very averse to inflation. So to me, I think there is as great or even a greater risk that the Fed, in worrying about inflation, will actually put us into a double dip.
We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Nobel Prize-winning economist, best-selling author Joseph Stiglitz. He now teaches at Columbia University in New York. His new book is Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy. Our next caller is someone in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello. When the brokerage houses sold these CDOs or derivatives, they in effect, then once they sold them, they turned around and went short the product they sold. Now, that to me should be legal because you know when they were selling them, they were saying everything positive about them because they wanted a commission, and then they turned around and went short.
I agree with you. I think it's unconscionable. You know, they try to say, well, the guys who bought it were wanted those products. But the fact is, when you buy a product from somebody, you expect them to stand behind it and say, I'll give you a guarantee. What they were doing was saying, this is a negative guarantee. We think it's such a bad product that we're selling you that we're selling it short. We're betting that you're going to lose money on it. I would feel, you know, if they disclose that to the buyer, that would be one thing, you know. But I can bet you they didn't disclose that to the buyers. And as you said, they were telling the buyers these are good products, you're going to get good return, and behind the backs they were selling it short. And to me, that ought to be illegal.
And aren't banks still too big to fail? And are they putting up at least more earnest capital on any venture that they get involved in?
The problem of too-big-to-fail banks has become much worse since the crisis. So the problem is even worse than it was before, and for two reasons. The first is that the way we bailed out the banks, we gave a disproportionate amount of money to the big banks. We let the smaller banks go bankrupt. 140 banks went bankrupt, the smaller banks went bankrupt last year alone. So our financial structure is getting more and more distorted. The small banks disappearing, the big banks getting bigger, the more and more concentration among the big banks, and that means the problems of too big to bank, too big to fail banks are even worse. The second thing, really big mistake, was that we extended the concept of too big to fail. We not only bailed out the banks, but we bailed out the bankers, the shareholders, and the bondholders. We extended the concept of the safety net, the corporate safety net, immensely. And this, of course, encourages people to these too big to fail banks to take even bigger risks, putting more and more potential cost on the American taxpayers.
Well, you, I know that you have also talked about the problem of leverage, and it's kind of complicated. It's essentially the way I understand it is the problem maybe is that banks really aren't required to actually have real assets to cover the bets that they make, and that there ought to be some requirement that says you can't do that.
That's right. I mean, basically, what happened is they're very highly leveraged. That is to say, they have borrowed a lot of money to finance their investments.
Okay.
And what that means is that they make a small mistake in their investments, they can't make their debt obligations. So they were so highly levered that if the value of their investments went down by 3%, 4%, 5%, the banks were bankrupt. Now, the value of real estate, residential real estate, has gone down by 30%. So to the extent that they put money in that area, they were bankrupt over and over and over again. I mean, multiple. So we allowed the success leverage. Goldman Sachs and the other investment banks had actually gone to the SEC asking them to be allowed to have even more leverage back in 2004, and they were given the right to have even more leverage. So when we should have been tightening up on the banks as we saw the bubble grow, as we saw the risk increase, we should have been tightening up. We were doing exactly the opposite. We were loosening the standards.
Let's talk with someone in Mattoon. Line 3. Hello.
Yes, I have a question. You mentioned a lot about the banks being a problem, in which I agree that large banks did all they could do to gobble up as much money as they can. Then again, I went to a first-time buyer homeowner's seminar where they were to teach you the fundamentals of buying a home, what to look for, type of loan to get, etc. And you had to have a sheet that you had to have signed by the instructor showing that you received this training. I think it was 40 or 50 people were there, and if you had given them the chance to have that paper signed by that instructor and leave right away, they would have done it. I mean, most of the people jumped out of the room as soon as they could. I think two of us out of about that group stayed around there to get as much information as we could, and it seems to me like the government should have done more to help people educate themselves to take the responsibility of on their own. You know, I agree that it's very complicated material to deal with, especially first-time home buyer, but it's also the responsibility of the individual taking the loan out.
I agree with you. I think we need to put a lot more emphasis on financial education. I would put this, you know, into the high schools. I mean, everybody or most Americans wind up being homeowners. It's an important part of their education. But let me try to point out on the other side, even our financial wizards, people like Alan Greenspan, did not really understand the risks of the different kinds of products that the financial market was selling. He, for instance, at one point almost encouraged people to take out variable rate mortgages, pointing out that if he had taken them, they had taken them out, you know, a decade earlier, they would have done very well. Well, yes, they would have done very well because he had been responsible for bringing down interest rates to levels that they had never been. So the market clearly hadn't anticipated that. But when interest rates were down at 1%, there was only one way for them to go. And if they went up and you had a variable rate mortgage, you were going to be in a very difficult position. So the point is that some of our financial leaders did not understand the risks. And if that's the case, how can we expect first-time homeowners to understand the risks? And that's where I think a very important idea that's under discussion right now, a lot of controversy, is the Financial Product Safety Commission. I think it's absolutely essential. The point is that you would have people on the commission who represent not the interests of the bankers who want to push these products, but the interests of the consumers, the interests of the homeowners who are likely to be hurt with these products, whose main function, let's be honest about it, whose main function was to generate fees for the banks, not to minimize risk for the homeowners.
Do you think that we would actually see such a thing come into being?
Well, it's actually in the House bill, so the idea is there. Unfortunately, more than 80% of the banks have been made exempt from it. So we're in one of those things, half full or half empty, maybe 80% empty, 20% full. So I'm very optimistic that something will happen, but there's a lot of pressure by the banks against it. I'm still supportive of it, even though it's been eviscerated in key ways, because it will be the beginning of trying to make sure that we get more responsible lending.
Very short on time, but I do want to try to get one more caller. In Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. This question that I have may require only a very short answer.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything good to be said about Milton Friedman?
Well, let me say, put it the other way. I mean, Milton Friedman had some very important ideas that have had a lot of influence in economics, like the permanent income hypothesis. It's been, over the years, expanded on. Limitations have been better understood. He assumed the markets work much better than, in fact, they do. The critique of Milton Friedman was that much of what he was doing was not economics but ideology. He did not really focus on the very many limitations of the market. Examples of which we saw in the Great Depression, another example that we're seeing in the Great Recession of 2008. More generally, what's sometimes called the Chicago School, had a lot more faith in rationality. You look at than there ought to be. You look at what happened in this crisis. You look at the kinds of behavior of the banks and in a whole variety of ways, and it is impossible to reconcile that behavior with any notion of rational expectation. It is easy to reconcile the behavior with problems of information asymmetries and clearly exploitative behavior on the part of the financial institutions, all which comes to the bottom line. A modern economy, there is a need for regulation. He never appreciated that, and those who followed in his ideological perspective are to some extent responsible for the crisis that we are now facing. Yeah.
There we must leave it. I'm sorry to say we're at the end of the time you'd like to read more on the subject. You look for the book we've mentioned a couple of times. The title is Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy, just out from W.W. Norton by our guest Joseph Stiglitz. He teaches at Columbia University. He's now in Chicago today to give a talk on the University of Chicago campus. And Professor Stiglitz, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Enjoyed it.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for listening.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, located in Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
Hi, this is Masumi Rostad of the Pacifica String Quartet. Please join WILL 40 North Krannert and me for the new Docha Chamber Music Festival. We are playing at Radio Maria, Cakes on Walnut, and Jim Gould's in downtown Champaign, April 1st to 3rd. Docha will feature great music from some of our town's finest musicians, including Stefan Milenkovich, Dmitry Kuzov, Rudolf Hawken, and my group, the Pacifica Quartet. Admission is free. For more information, visit docha.org.
It's coming up on 12 noon, and let's take a quick look at the markets. May wheat in Kansas City at 485 and three quarters, up three quarters. July at 496 and three quarters, up one. September at 508 and a half, up three quarters. May wheat in Chicago, 475 and a quarter, down one and a half. July.